Before a different world came into its own, and before higher learning and dear white people critiqued the fraught relationship between black students and white students at predominantly white institutions, there was this 80s flick. Multi-talented Spike Lee's sophomore future took a critical look at historically black colleges and universities, also known as HBCUs, revealing their beauty and complexity in a decade where black faces seemed to be only an afterthought in mainstream media. So get ready to wake up as my wife and HBCU graduate herself, Tyra Williams, and I discuss School Days from 1988 on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast.
So, Half Pint, what can I do for you?
Well, I was wondering maybe we could see each other, go out to a movie, a restaurant, pop some Jiffy Pop popcorn together, you know, enjoy each other's company.
Yeah, sure. That'd be nice. That sounds real good. Why don't you come by after you go over? I'm usually in at night.
I was thinking soon.
How soon?
Like now at the Gamma
House. Sorry. I can't.
We could have fun. Big fun. Just give me one reason why not. Just one.
First of all, I don't know you from Adam. You just pop out of thin air and I'm supposed to say yes?
I've always been attracted to you. I just couldn't tell you before. I was shy. But now that I've been pleasuring, I'm a different person.
Well, I'm not attracted to you. Besides, I don't want a physical relationship. All you guys are dogs. I've heard about you gammas.
I'm not trying to dog you. Look at my face. Can a real gamma man be attracted to you? Huh?
Is this some type of a joke? Did your big brother send you over here? I don't have time for children's games. You're so small, I'd probably break you in two.
Hello, movie viewers and movie lovers. My name is Tim Williams, and welcome to the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Here we talk about all the great and sometimes not so great movies from the 1980s. From blockbusters to cult classics to lesser known treasures we discovered on cable TV or the now defunct video rental stores from our childhood. No matter which 80s flick we choose for each episode, we have a lot of fun sharing memories, discussing our favorite scenes, and even learning some behind-the-scenes stories about the cast and crew along the way. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe and follow 80s Flick Flashback on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite podcast platform is. And while you're there, leave us a stellar written review and a 5-star rating. You can also support the show by following us on our social media pages. Just search for 80s Flick Flashback on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And go ahead and check out our website, 80sflickflashback.com, for more great 80s content. Now, let's jump right into this episode. Thanks for listening. So welcome in, everybody. Excited about this episode that my wife has wanted to do for a while. I'm glad to have my wife on the podcast with us for the second time. We did one a couple of years ago.
Hey, everybody.
So for those of you who don't know, we are a multi or interracial couple. I am white and my wife is black or African-American.
You could say multiracial. We don't know who we are.
Actually, we'd wanted to do an episode like this during February, during Black History Month, and we started looking at some of the movies to do, and we were planning to do one on Glory, but just couldn't get it all put together in time. But this was the one that she was the most excited about. about doing. So here it is. We're going to talk about School Days from 1988, Spike Lee's second movie. So let's jump right in. So, Tyra, when did you see School Days for the very first time?
I saw it when it came out, but I guess I only watched it once or twice because when we watched it again this week and it opened up, I was like, oh, my God, that's Larry. Is that Lawrence Fishburne? You know, so it was really good to watch it again, of course, but it brought back a whole lot of memories. So can't wait to
jump into that part.
Jump into that, yeah.
Yeah, I saw this on video. I remember reading about it because, of course, I was big. When this came out, I was really big into movies. Entertainment Weekly was a magazine I read
pretty rarely. So I knew who Spike Lee was. I had not seen, I don't think I've ever seen She's Gotta Have It, which was his first movie. Right. But I remember seeing the commercials for this and knowing it was, I expected it to be kind of like more of a comedy than it kind of was in the end. And so I remember watching it and not really understanding much about it. And as we watched it again for the podcast, there were still some things in it that I didn't fully get. And we'll talk about that because it's obvious that I was not, or I am not the main audience that Spike Lee was making this movie for. So it's okay that I don't get it or get some of the things that it was saying right. because it wasn't directed at me. So, so how long had it been since you watched it before watching it for the podcast?
Ooh, some 20-some years, I guess. Oh, my gosh. You know, Spike Lee's made so many movies since that
right,
one. So,
right.
You know, and I was a pretty big Spike Lee fan at the time. So because this was, you know, a black guy making movies mm-hmm. for black people to watch that black people could actually relate to. So mm-hmm. I was definitely a fan. So, but it had been probably 20 years.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't, like I said, I knew I hadn't seen it since I watched it on video when it came out. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like watching it again for the first time. There were certain scenes, the scenes that I kind of remembered, I think that was in the trailer. There were certain things that I remember I had seen a couple of times, so a couple of lines and things in the movie, but it was like watching it again for the first time for me. So, mm-hmm. So let's jump in a little bit about how the movie was made, as we do on the podcast, and we'll just talk through it. So.
Okay.
Based in part on Spike Lee's experiences as a Morehouse student in the Atlanta University Center during the 70s, it is a story about undergraduates in a fraternity and sorority clashing with some of their classmates at a historically black college during homecoming weekend. It also touches upon issues of colorism, elitism, classism, political activism, hazing, groupthink, female self-esteem, social mobility, and hair texture bias within the African-American community. Accurate?
I would say yes. That's a lot.
Yeah.
It touches on a lot.
It yes. does. Yeah, it really does. This was supposed to be the second film in Spike Lee's 3-film deal with Island Pictures after She's Gotta Have It, he made in 86. However, Lee got a call from Island saying they no longer wanted to make the film because it was too expensive and they lost confidence in Lee and his production crew. The next day, Lee was at Columbia Pictures with David Putnam and David V. Picker for a negative pickup deal. The budget was increased to $6.5 million, and the film was made. So, I don't think I have it on here, but basically he made She's Gotta Have It for like $150,000, and it grossed like $6 million. So, it made a profit. So, that's why mm-hmm. Universal was like, we'll give you some money. Cause,
yeah, well, thank you, Universal.
Right. Because, you know, you're coming off a strong first movie. We think we can take a chance
mm-hmm.
on this one. So, like I said, She's Gotta Have It, which was Lee's first movie. But he worked with cinematographer Dickerson. I don't have his first name. I didn't make it in my notes. But it was his third feature film. And so some of this I'm going to go over in this is from an interview with Dickerson about working on the film. There wasn't a whole lot of behind the scenes that I could find about the movie being made. Most of it came out of this kind of interview mm-hmm. with Dickerson. So a lot of it is going to come from his perspective. She's Gotta Have It astonished the film community in 1986 by being produced in 12 days on a total budget of $175,000. By the end of that year, the film had grossed $7 million. So it wasn't off too much by stats, by memory. So it was a critical success and profitability of the film that persuaded Columbia to put up $6 million to finance School Days, which went into production in early March 1987. With such an enormous jump in film budget size, even Lee admits that many people at the time openly wondered if he and his crew could handle it. 8 weeks later, when the production ended on time, within budget, and with no reshoots, it was clear they could. Approximately 75% of the film was shot in the Atlanta University complex. Spelman, Morehouse, and Clark Atlanta University eventually revoked access to their campuses during shooting because they had concerns over how HBCUs were being depicted in the film. Lee had to finish filming in the neighboring Morris Brown College to remain on schedule, according to the DVD commentary. Now, I know you went to Clark Atlanta.
Right.
So how much of it did you see in the movie? How did you recognize? I know there's one
part I recognize a lot of it. Yeah, I mean, the yard, man. It was just like, oh, my gosh. And then One of the scenes outside the dorm, I was like, oh gosh, what dorm is that? You know? And then I'm familiar with Morris Brown campus as well. I used to hang over there too. So it was just, yeah. So I recognized pretty much all of it.
So they also used the stage of the old Fox Theater in downtown Atlanta for a series of major theatrical numbers, which included the crowning of the homecoming queen and two song and dance numbers. In fact, most of the music springs out of situations within the story, such as the performances given at the theater. Dickerson said, there is only one number that springs out of nowhere in the manner of the old MGM musicals, and that is a number performed in a beauty salon called Straight and Nappy. The scene and the Fox Theater number, The Sun is Rising, are both shot in the manner of 1940s Technicolor movies. Mm-hmm. He said, Spike and I looked at a lot of old musicals like West Side Story and American in Paris, Singing in the Rain, and Busby Berkeley films to see how the treatment of dance has changed since then. He said, our journey with School Days began upon reading the script, but it gained a real momentum when we attended an actual homecoming celebration at the school where we were planning to shoot. Part of our plan was to photograph the homecoming parade and football game as a kind of pre-production second unit. However, we got more out of it than spectacular footage. We experienced firsthand the moods and energies we would have to recreate for the screen. There was so much energy in the stands at the football game that when it became obvious the home team was losing, people forgot all about the game and started partying among themselves. Losing the game wasn't going to stop their homecoming celebrations. Also, since the real game was being played between mine and Spike's old schools, and my school was winning, a new dimension was added to the cameraman-director relationship, he joked. The football game also influenced Dickerson's decision about the overall look for the film. He said the stadium became a colorful mass of people of all colors, dancing and singing in unison as if they were one entity. A similar approach was taken with the football scene where the 500 extras had to be made to look like a crowd of 5,000. He said this was all we could get because several other films were being made in Atlanta at the same time, and most of them could pay the extras more money. We shot the crowds from the stands and then shot Ossie Davis, who plays the coach. After shooting him from the sidelines, his face was so expressive, Spike felt that there was no need to photograph the game at all, so he canceled it, which I thought was interesting. I was noticing that in watching the movie during that scene. I was like, they're not showing any of the football game. You're only getting the reactions of the stands and the coach. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm thinking as a filmmaker, that's very smart because we've covered other football movies, specifically thinking about when we did All the Right Moves, which we talked about how they had to film that, like that one football game took like three nights, you know, into the late hours, and having people in the stands, you got to pay them that time. So mm-hmm. to not show the football game at all and just do the reactions was a smart way to do that,
where you can depict what's going on right, just by the looks right, on people's right. faces. Yeah.
And this wasn't necessarily a football movie, mm-mm. quote unquote, so it's not wasn't totally necessary. But I'm sure it helped stay on budget and stay on your timeline, you know, when you had to be done. So
not to mention that any football game mm-hmm. at HBCU, the stands are live anyway. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter who's winning or losing, because you got the chants, the songs, the dances, the majorettes, you know, the halftime show is mm-hmm. is always full of energy. So mm-hmm. You know, forget the game. We just getting together to have fun.
And now these messages.
Coming soon to a cell phone near you, a show for all the manly men out there, where guys talk about their favorite movies and what they can teach us about being a man. Featuring the coolest guests.
Murder somebody is not like killing an ant.
The most gratifying laughs.
It's Tombstone, what can I say?
A fresh take on movies like you've never heard before.
This will be the thing that gets written on his proverbial tombstone.
We aren't here to criticize the movies you love, but to praise them for how they apply to our lives as husbands, fathers, and really all men in general. So buckle your seatbelts, because Manly Movies is coming your way on March 31st. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or your other favorite podcast catcher. And remember, man up.
What seems to be the problem, pal?
There's just so much pain in the world, so many issues. I don't think I can bear it.
Well, friendo, it sounds like you could use a dose of Pop Culture Roulette.
Pop Culture Roulette? What's that? Some sort of pop culture-themed podcast or something?
That's right, sonny boy. When hope seems far, dive into some PCR.
But I already get my entertainment news from Variety.
Huh, that's pretty good. If you're a chucklehead, PCR gives you news you need, condensed, unfiltered, and raw, from three nerds who know a little something about something.
Wow, okay, sign me up.
That's the spirit. Pop Culture Roulette. New episodes every Monday, available on all major podcast directories.
So one thing that Spike Lee did was he had the actors stay in separate hotels during filming. The actors playing the wannabes had better accommodations than those playing the jigaboos.
Wow.
Which contributed to the on-camera animosity between the two camps. The step show scene was the result of the animosity. According to Lee, the fight between the jigaboos and wannabes was real. So the fight that broke out at the end. Yeah. Now,
I believe it.
I'm saying this word, jigaboos. Would you like to define that for this movie? And is it acceptable for us to even say on this podcast? For me to say on this podcast?
So I'll speak for you. So, of course, wannabes in essence are more lighter skin, African-Americans, maybe have nice hair or light eyes. And so they would be considered wannabes, like they're trying to be white.
Mm-hmm.
Jigaboos would be more darker skinned African-Americans, maybe wear their hair natural,
mm-hmm.
and more down for the cause of being, black and proud to be black and not afraid to show that they are black.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't help it if your skin is dark either. So
right.
you can't pass, you know, that type of thing. So, yeah. Which even in the song, in that scene when it when they're in the salon, when they're talking about good and bad hair, the wannabes even reference the jigaboos have a kitchen, or the back of their hair right at the nape of their neck is nappy, is hard to comb. And so that would reference jigaboo. So,
yeah. Yeah. But in essence, they're both derogatory terms mm-hmm. towards each other.
It is.
And yep. so, okay. So, I hate to ask this question, but I'm going to.
Yeah,
for those that don't know you, would you fall under the wannabes or the...
Wow. on look alone, I would fall under the wannabes. And it's funny because having attended an HBCU...
Right, right.
That was not Spelman. you learn so much about who you are, and then when you go home and you're speaking, you know, you're talking about referencing Black history, Black culture, the cause. I was always told often, "Girl, you wanna be," you know, so I can relate to being called a wannabe.
Mm-hmm.
You're always talking that Black power stuff. You're a wannabe. Well. Not really, because, and it is derogatory,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, the shade of your skin tone does not depict how Black you are
right.
or are not.
Right,
but,
right.
But the movie really does dig into those internal cultural issues,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, a little fun fact, we were talking about this, I looked this up while we were watching the movie, but we're big Food Network fans, but Alton Brown, host of Food Network's Good Eats,
mm-hmm.
That was his first show, he's done other shows since then, he was actually the Steadicam operator for this movie, which I thought
really
was fantastic,
cool.
Which I know he's from Georgia, so it makes sense that him getting into the business, he was probably doing,
right.
you know, what he could, and would probably, he was probably cheap to get back then, too.
right.
So, but thanks to Columbia Pictures executive David V. Picker, Spike Lee got final cut rights for the film, which was very rare for any director at the time, which just goes to show, I'll talk a little bit more about Spike when we get to the cast, some of his background. But one of the biggest things you'll notice in this movie is that the film came out when A Different World, the hit TV show, was in the middle of its first season. It was also set at a fictional, historically African-American college.
Mm-hmm.
Jasmine Guy, Daryl Bell, and Kadeem Hardison starred on the show. Tisha Campbell appeared in two episodes as Josie Webb, an HIV-positive student.
Right.
So all those are names that are in this movie as we're going to move into casting. So
mm-hmm. Cool.
All right. So as she said, Larry, as he went in 88, Larry Fishburne as Vaughn Dapp Dunlap. But Lawrence was born in Augusta, Georgia. His mother transplanted her family to Brooklyn after his parents divorced. There's an interesting, we're going to notice a thing that gets repeated a lot of people that were born in Georgia that moved to New York. That are in this movie. They're all like, they have ties to Georgia, but somehow they all end up in New York. But anyway, so Larry is the first one. So anyway, in 1973, at the age of 12, young Lawrence won a recurring role on the daytime soap opera One Life to Live that lasted three seasons. Yeah. He subsequently made his film debut in the ghetto-themed Cornbread Earl and Me in 1975.
Yes, good one.
At 14, Francis Ford Coppola cast him in Apocalypse Now in 1979, which filmed for 2 years in the Philippines, which I remember I just watched Apocalypse Now within the last year, and seeing him in that movie was like, and he looked like a kid. I was like, he couldn't have been old enough to be in the movie, and really he wasn't. He lied about his age to be in that movie, so... but it's a 79 movie, so we won't talk about it in the 80s podcast, but a little trivia there for you. Lawrence didn't work for another year and a half, but Coppola was impressed enough with Lawrence to hire him again down the road and down the line with featured roles in Rumblefish in 83, The Cotton Club in 84, and Gardens of Stone, which came out in 87. So he was already pretty well established at this point, but this was a big, big, big breakout role for him. One thing that you may notice, his signature tooth gap is noticeably missing in this movie. He had his teeth capped for this role.
Wow.
Yeah. Which I didn't, I thought he looked different. I think he just thought he looked younger. Mm-hmm. But when I read that, I was like, oh yeah, his teeth weren't, the gap wasn't as big in this one as in other movies. So next on the list, we have a lot to cover. I'm going to try to hit these as quick as I can. Giancarlo Esposito as Julian. Yes. Big Dean Brother Almighty Eves. Giancarlo, full name, Giancarlo Giuseppe Alessandro Esposito, was born in Copenhagen, Denmark, the son of an Italian stagehand and carpenter from Naples, and his mother was an African-American opera and nightclub singer from Alabama.
Wow.
What a combo.
What a combo.
When he was six, his family moved to Manhattan. Esposito made his Broadway debut in 1968, playing an enslaved child opposite Shirley Jones in the short-lived musical Maggie Flynn, set during the New York draft riots of 1863. He was also a member of the youthful cast of the Stephen Sondheim Harold Prince collaboration Merrily We Roll Along, which closed with 16 performances and 56 previews in 81. During the 80s, Esposito appeared in films such as Maximum Overdrive, King of New York, and Trading Places. He also performed in TV shows such as Miami Vice and Spencer for Hire. And he also played a cadet in the 1981 movie Taps, which is a good movie, underrated movie we'll eventually get to. In 88, he landed his breakout role in this film, School Days. Over the next 4 years, he and Lee collaborated on three other movies, Do the Right Thing, Mo Better Blues, and Malcolm X.
Yep.
But he's one of those actors, like, you'll see him in things that I forget how long of a career he's had. I mean,
right, because who knew he was that old?
Right, exactly. Which I will say, in this movie, like, everybody looks older than they should be in college. I mean, you know, even Lawrence Fishburne looks like he's in his 30s. Maybe it's the beard, but they all look like they're in their late 20s, early 30s, which they probably really were, and not 18, 19, 20 year olds. Mm-hmm. So, but Esposito, like, I remember when I took notice of him in Breaking Bad, the TV show that was out about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. He had an excellent actor.
Yeah, fantastic actor. And then, of course, he's been in some recent seasons of The Mandalorian. So he's definitely still working. A lot of these are still working. Yeah. We've got to see them in their early prime. So next on the list, Tisha Campbell as Jane Toussaint. Campbell was born in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, but raised in Newark, New Jersey. Another person moving. Where she attended Newark Arts High School and also East Orange, New Jersey, where she attended Washington Academy of Music. Her mother, Mona Washington, was a nurse, talent manager, gospel singer, and vocal coach. Her father, Clifton, was a factory worker and singer, as well as a chess master. Her mom was also her manager, and has been her manager for a long time. At age 17, she performed in the movie musical Little Shop of Horrors as Chiffon, one of the Supremes' light girl group Greek Chorus, along with future Martin co-star, Tashina Arnold. Thank you. Bad with names. After graduating from the Arts High School in Newark, she moved to Hollywood, where she became a star on the short-lived NBC musical comedy drama series Rags to Riches, which I vaguely remember. Tyra has no recollection of that movie.
That one.
So Vanessa Williams was originally considered for the role of Jane Toussaint. However, Spike Lee was impressed with Tisha's singing in Little Shop of Horrors, so she got the part. There's also reports that Vanessa Williams turned down the role because she thought it was too controversial, which I could see that as well.
Like her career was not controversial in the beginning. But anyway. Right.
She had her own controversies, yes. Which maybe that's why she was like, I got enough stuff going on.
Not enough drama.
So the actress Kyme, as Rachel Meadows, which was Dap's girlfriend, she really did not do much. She's mostly remembered for School Days. She has worked in television with guest appearances on Chicago Hope, The Parkers, Frasier, NYPD Blue, and 24. Okay. But didn't really do much after this as far as like theatrical movies. So moving down the line, Joe Seneca as President Harold McPherson, which we talked about. There is a there's a Ford McPherson here in Atlanta. We wondered if that name was because of that reference, because Tyler Perry's studios bought the old Fort McPherson, which was an army base that my dad worked on when I was younger. So a lot of connections for us being Atlanta natives, or not really natives, but we live in Atlanta.
We've been here long enough.
Yeah. So Joe Seneca, before his acting career, he belonged to the R&B group The Three Riffs, which was active from the late 40s and performed at upscale supper clubs in New York City. He was also a songwriter and had big hits with Talk to Me, sung by Little Willie John, and Break It to Me Gently, which was a smash hit by Brenda Lee in 1962 and Juice Newton in 1982. 20 years difference. In the 1982 film The Verdict, Seneca played the supporting role of Dr. Thompson, a small-town women's hospital physician brought in by attorney Frank Galvin, played by Paul Newman. Arguably, his most well-known roles are that of blues man Willie Brown in Crossroads with Ralph Macchio in 1986 and Dr. Meadows in The Blob in 88, the evil head of a government team sent to contain the title creature. He's also made multiple appearances on The Cosby Show as Hillman president, Dr. Zechariah J. Haynes. So he played college president or university president in both of those. Ellen Holly as Audrey McPherson, his wife. Beginning her career on stage in late 50s, Holly is perhaps best known for her role as Carla Gray Hall on the ABC daytime soap opera One Life to Live. She is noted as the first African-American to appear on daytime television in a leading role, which is what I thought was good to keep her.
Very nice. Nice to note.
Yeah. Art Evans as Cedar Cloud. One of Evans' early roles was the first victim in the John Carpenter film Christine, based on the novel by Stephen King. In 84, Evans co-starred in the all-star African-American drama A Soldier Story as the memorable brown-nosing character Wilkie. He's probably best known, which is what I remembered him from, as Leslie Barnes in the action film Die Hard 2 in 1990, where he played the air traffic controller tower employee at Dulles International Airport helping John McClane. His other film credits include Into the Night in 85, Fright Night in 85 as well, Jojo Dancer, Your Life is Calling in 86, Ruthless People in 86, and The Mighty Quinn in 89. So he's one of those, you know, kind of character actors that as soon as he showed up on the screen, I recognized him immediately, but I would never know that was his name. So, but moving on, Ossie Davis.
Ossie Davis.
You were excited to see as Coach Odom, which his speech before the game is hilarious. He was born on December 18, 1917 in Cogdale, Georgia. The county clerk misunderstood his mother's dialectal pronunciation of his initials RC when he was born. He thought he heard Aussie and registered him as such. The name stuck. So his name was actually the letter RC Davis, but it came out as Ossie Davis.
Wow.
He was an actor and writer known for Do the Right Thing, Bubba Hotep, and The Client. He appeared with his wife Ruby Dee in 9 films, No Way Out in 1950, Gone Are the Days in 1963, The Sheriff in 71, Cool Red in 76, Roots, The Next Generations in 79, All God's Children in 1980, Do the Right Thing in 89, Jungle Fever in 91, and The Stand TV miniseries in 1994.
Whew. Awesome.
Ossie Davis. Bill Nunn as Grady, which is that's who we kept saying, like, we knew this guy looked familiar. And I was like, I couldn't think of his name watching the movie. But Bill Nunn, as soon as I saw it, I was like, yeah, that's the guy's name. As Grady, the football player, he made his, this was his credited film debut in School Days. He's best known for his roles as Radio Raheem in Do the Right Thing and as Nino Brown's bodyguard, the man in New Jack City.
When we saw him, there's Radio Raheem.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of his other film credits include Lee's Mo Better Blues and He Got Game, as well as Regarding Henry, Sister Act, which is what I should have remembered him from. And he was in the Spider-Man trilogy as Joseph Robbie Robertson, the first Spider-Man trilogy, because there's...
How many Spider-Man trilogies?
There's two of them now. In the 2016 televised adaptation of A Raisin in the Sun. Bill Nunn, he passed away, I think, in 2016. Mm-hmm. But I remember when he passed away, that was like a big thing because people... He's such a memorable face, a memorable actor that probably didn't get a lot of the recognition that he should have, or the name recognition that he should have. And this one was cool because I thought this was him, but I didn't look it up until after. Branford Marsalis.
Is that who that was?
It's Jordan, yeah.
Oh, man. Okay, because I kept looking like, who is that?
Yeah. Okay. So, if you don't know, Branford Marsalis is the eldest son of the first family of jazz, born August 26, 1960. He is an established saxophonist and outspoken iconoclast. He has collaborated with the likes of Herbie Hancock, Art Blakey, Terrence Blanchard, Sting, Guru, Miles Davis, Bruce Hornsby, and his brother Wynton. He was the original band leader for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno for nearly 3 years until he walked away to return to his love of jazz music. His only other film credits included Throw Mama from the Train, a very bit part. He was an extra or like he's on a small scene in Mo Better Blues. And he was also in Eve's Bayou. But he also performed many of the saxophone solos in the score. But I know him because Mo Better Blues was a movie that a friend of mine in high school, he would like love that movie so much, but he loved jazz music. And so he would give me cassettes of Branford Marsalis' music. So that's why I recognized him immediately.
Okay.
But yeah, that's Mo Better Blues is another one that I haven't watched in a long time. I need to go back and see Spike Lee's movies. All right. We're getting through it. You still with us? Okay, here we go. Still some names that you know. Look, I didn't include a lot of people but we didn't recognize them. This is just people that we actually know that are in this movie. So Kadeem Hardison as Edge, best known for his role as Dwayne Wayne on Different World.
Dwayne.
He also starred in the Disney Channel series Casey Undercover as Craig Cooper, the title character's father. Of course, Zendaya was the main actor in that movie. His other film credits include I'm Gonna Get You Sucka in 88, same year, White Men Can't Jump in 92, and Vampire in Brooklyn in 95 with Eddie Murphy. Then you got to talk about Spike Lee as Daryl Half Pint Dunlap.
Half Pint. Now became a full pint.
Right. So when he was a child, the family moved from Atlanta, where he was born, to Brooklyn. There's a second Georgia to Brooklyn or New York connection. His mother actually nicknamed him Spike during his childhood. That's not his birth certificate name. Yeah. But Lee enrolled in Morehouse College, where he made his first student film, Last Hustle in Brooklyn. He took film courses at Clark Atlanta University and graduated with a BA in Mass Communication from Morehouse. He did graduate work at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, where he earned a Master of Fine Arts in Film and Television. So... there's a lot to be said about Spike Lee. I mean, it could do almost a whole episode on the things that he's done.
Just on Spike Lee, yes.
But, you know, love him or hate him, I can't say that I love every Spike Lee movie, but I do respect him as a director. He does definitely has a vision.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always agree with the choices that he makes, even in this movie.
He's an artist, nonetheless.
But yes, but he one thing about it is you know it's a Spike Lee movie when you watch it.
Yep.
Even if it's a, like, probably my favorite Spike Lee movie is Inside Job. But it's not a typical Spike Lee movie. He did that for a studio. I mean, he made that movie to make money, basically. But it still had his stamp on it.
It
has a signature. And so, and he was good in this. I mean, going back to when I saw the previews for this, they emphasized his character a lot in the previews. So I expected the movie to be more about him. And it really wasn't. And I think that's why I probably was more disappointed in the movie when I watched it the first time, because I was expecting it to be
about
Half Pint and him trying to be, you know, get into pledge. But he was really more of a side character. It was an important part of the story, but he didn't. But also smart for him as a director. You don't want to be the main guy. Mm-hmm. You've got other things you got to deal with.
Right.
He became more the main guy in Do the Right Thing the next year or so. All right, then we got Daryl M. Bell as Big Brother X-Ray Vision. Daryl was born in Chicago, Illinois, Tyra's hometown. It wasn't long after graduating from Syracuse University that he was cast as smooth-talking schemer Ron Johnson on A Different World, which was Dwayne Wayne's best friend. Bell has also appeared in Living Single, Cosby, For Your Love, and co-starred in Homeboys in Outer Space. Those are all TV shows from the late 80s and 90s. What I did not know is that Daryl Bell and Tempest Bledsoe of Cosby Show fame have been together since 1993, but have never married.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
And then our last A Different World connection, Jasmine Guy as Dina. Another really small role in this movie, but you recognize her as soon as you see her on the screen. She began her television career with a non-speaking role as a dancer in 7 episodes of the 1982 television series Fame under the direction of choreographer Debbie Allen. Guy today remains best known for her starring role as Whitley Gilbert in A Different World. She wrote 3 episodes of the show and directed one, in addition to appearing in every episode. What's amazing is she started as a co-star but ended up replacing the show's original star, Lisa Bonet, who left the series. Guy was nominated for and won 6 consecutive NAACP Image Awards for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series. Mm-hmm. So, and then she's still doing work today, too. Yeah. So, and then last on the list, which we have to mention, the one and only Samuel L. Jackson.
Samuel Jackson.
As Leeds, but in IMDb, it has Leeds, I guess, is his name, but next to it is the local yokel is actually the name of that group in that scene.
Oh, wow.
Won't jump much into Samuel Jackson, just that after 1981 performance in the play A Soldier's Play, Jackson was introduced to director Spike Lee, who cast him for small roles in School Days and Do the Right Thing, which helped him kind of get started. I think he was actually, I want to say his film debut was in Coming to America in 87, where he plays the robber in the one scene, but one of his early scenes. But another one, we could do an episode just on Samuel Jackson, just on Spike Lee, just on Lawrence Fishburne, just for the magnitude of their careers, and Esposito.
And Ossie,
yeah. So, you know, you got a lot of heavy hitters in this for sure. So, any favorites in the cast, like anybody that stood out to you as like, would be your, because this is such a big cast. It's like we usually talk about favorites, or anybody stood out to you as your favorite, or
I can't say I have a favorite. I just have a favorite scene. It's always,
well, we're gonna get to favorite scenes.
Yeah, so I don't, I can't say that I really have a favorite
character,
but I just love when they say Big Brother Almighty. But Big Brother Almighty really does play his character well, as far as the leader of the fraternity and hazing. I mean, he does, having the girlfriend, and you know, he really plays that part well.
Yeah. I don't know if I have a favorite character either, because it jumps from so many different characters. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you would want to say that. I mean, Lawrence Fishburne clearly is the lead. Like, it's, you're primarily following his character. Mm-hmm. But everybody's so complex, which is cool too. There's nobody is, I mean, I think Big Brother Almighty really seems to be the, I wouldn't say the, he's the real protagonist, I mean, sorry, the antagonist of the film, on multiple levels.
Right. And Fishburne's character, you know, Dunlap, is like, he wants to be understood. He feels like he's misunderstood.
Right.
You know, he just wants to be heard.
And
it seems like both characters are at a crossroads with themselves and their identities.
Yeah.
And now these messages.
Comic books have been around for almost a century, and in the last 2 decades, we've finally gotten to see many of these characters brought to life in movies and on TV. On the Moving Panels podcast, we discuss movies and TV shows based on, inspired by, and adapted from the world of comic books. Join me and my guests as we discuss both the good and the bad from Marvel, DC, and even some of the lesser-known comic book companies. Learn what is and isn't from the comics, as well as our nerdy review of the movie or show. New episodes drop every Monday, and you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. So join us for Moving Panels, and I'll see you on the other side of the page.
What's up, dudes? I'm Jerry D of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, books, fashion, and fads.
If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, he's got it covered. Wait, is there a lot of things to talk about for the 80s and Christmas?
Well, you got the movie giants like Christmas Vacation, Scrooged, and A Christmas Story. There are TV specials like Muppet Family Christmas, Claymation Christmas Celebration, and a Garfield Christmas Special.
Plus classics shown every year.
You also jam out to Last Christmas, Do They Know It's Christmas, and Christmas in Hollis. But most of all, it was a time for the most bodacious, best-selling Christmas toys ever, like He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers,
and Cabbage Patch Kids.
Yes, them too. We cover them all, plus much more, including standard segments like Hap Hap Happiest Memory, Gagney with the Spoon, The Other Half of the Battle,
and Chant with the Littles.
So tune in to Totally Rad Christmas everywhere you get your podcasts. Turn the clock back and dive into those warm and fuzzy memories.
Later, dudes.
All right, well, let's go ahead and we'll jump into favorite scenes. This is kind of what you wanted to get into. So, iconic scene, favorite scene.
The hair salon, of course.
Oh, yeah.
The song, the dance. And that when you mentioned earlier about the how they studied some 1940s mm-hmm. like musicals and stuff.
Yeah.
And you mentioned West Side Story. I could see how they were depicted as two gangs.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah, you know, especially
the
sing
off, dance off, the arguments.
Scene. Yeah.
That scene. You could really, especially after having recently watched
right.
the new West Side Story.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Oh my gosh. You could see that being depicted. That scene, of course, the football game scene with the dancing, the cheering, and just that whole thing is such a huge part of the college experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which is so cool that, you know, to hear the history of that and that why they didn't use any football game scenes, they
mm-hmm.
just used the faces and expressions of everybody in the stands because you could tell what was going on with
right,
the game.
Right.
So, you know, it's just, that was just really smart. And that was really, really cool. The behind the scene information about that, how
mm-hmm.
they came to the determination, let's just do this instead of using football players in the
right,
actual game. So,
right.
That was really cool. And I guess that one scene where they're being hazed and they're being hit with the paddle and how each one
has
a different comment.
Reaction.
Yes. That is so funny.
Now,
so hilarious.
Yeah. Now there are a lot of lines and songs of this that you were saying along with the movie and knowing, even though you've only seen it a few times. So I want to know, being at HBCU in college, how frequently referenced was this movie? Like, is this like when you come in freshman year, you're like, if you haven't seen School Days, we're all going to sit down tonight and watch it so you can understand the, so you get all the inside jokes. I mean, is it?
No, I wouldn't say. I wouldn't say it like that. Like School Days.
I'm being facetious.
Taught the lesson. No,
right,
but
right.
But
surely it's highly referenced. Well, at least when you were there in the.
So, it's not so much that School Days was highly referenced. It is what was going on campuses that the movie referenced. It's not like Spike Lee made that stuff up.
Oh, yeah, right.
That stuff
that's just real
actually,
stuff.
It's just
yeah.
real stuff. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Like some of the fraternity chants. I
mm-hmm.
mean, it's just real stuff. So,
okay.
So like, a real man is a gamma man. Ooh. A gamma man is a real man.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Certain fraternities say similar things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just poetic.
Yeah,
if
yeah.
you will. So yeah. So, and some of the things at the football game is like, yeah, those were cheers that we did in the stands.
Oh, yeah,
you
yeah.
Know,
yeah, I recognize some of the cheers.
So,
yeah,
or chants, if you will.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's not like in a handbook that this is what you're going to...
No, no, no.
You know, but
yeah.
No, I know, but
yeah.
I'm just saying, it's not so much as in a handbook or that the movie taught it to you.
Right.
It's what was actually going on
yeah.
on campuses. So, the movie depicts the life
right.
really well.
Right. So, it's a very accurate depiction of life at HBCU in the late 80s. Early 90s.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's still artistic.
Oh, yeah,
yes.
yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's like, it's
but
not
yeah.
documentary, but
yeah, yeah.
it's still, he definitely used, I mean, once again, he pulled from his own experiences.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
But, yeah, so we'll talk a little bit more. We're going to talk about the end here in a little bit, kind of talk about what the movie is saying. But for me, for favorite scenes, the football game, like which I already said, because of the way it was shot, I just thought that was really, really cool. I think trying to think any other scenes that really jumped out at me. Some of the hazing scenes were funny, like the comedy scenes. Mm-hmm. The scene with them running to the local yokels, you know, the KFC, was interesting. Mm-hmm. We both said, like, why would you leave your food? I mean, y'all just had somebody pay for all your food, and you just leave it there. I mean, at least take the... I was with Kareem. I was like, man, let's eat.
Grab, yeah, eat food, at least.
At least put it in a bag and take it with you.
Run out with the tray, do something.
Right. So, but yeah. So a few trivia for some of the scenes, and then I want to talk a little bit about the ending and what the movie was really about and what it was saying. But Tisha Campbell has said she had no idea what a jigaboo was prior to joining the project, which I guess would make sense if she was the wannabe. once again, I'm saying right. Facetiously. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In the DVD commentary, she also said the blonde dye damaged her hair so badly she had to cut it all out. Which I'm sure.
I can believe that, yeah. Sure. Because that, especially at that time, yeah. You know, hair products in the 80s.
So Gamma Phi Gamma is a combination of two historically black fraternities, Alpha Phi Alpha and Omega Psi Psi. Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Omega Sci-fi members are known as?
The Dogs.
Q-Dogs. Mm-hmm. That's where Jeff pledged, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. A friend of ours we know. Was it? No. I know he pledged with one of them.
I don't remember. I think Jeff is an alpha, but I don't quite remember. Okay. But it's okay.
I just remember his tattoo. That's all I remember. Or his branding. Because he hit.
Was it a dog?
I don't remember. Oh. I just remember having him. Anyway.
I don't remember. Anyway. But Steve Harvey is a Q.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Q. Oh, Q dog. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. And their pledges used to shave their heads and eyebrows prior to becoming members. Alpha Phi Alpha colors are black and gold, and their mascot is the Sphinx. In the parade scene, the Gammas float as... has an Egyptian theme, so mm-hmm. He was kind of, it was a fictional college.
It was a play on
Mission
both.
College yeah. Was mm-hmm. a fictional college, yep. Even though they referenced True Black College in the speech at the beginning with right. the with the president and the board of director guy. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the fraternities and sororities were fake as well. So, right. So let's talk a little bit about the ending. We're going to kind of start wrapping things up. But so, as I said at the beginning, as a white man, this movie, I mean, I appreciate it for what it is, but I didn't understand what we would say the message of the movie was, because it definitely is a message movie, which you can see throughout. And so we were talking about it after the movie ended, after we finished watching, I was like, I still don't really get the end, because of course the pivotal scene for me is, which is the most controversial scene, is that Big Brother Almighty, we know he's going to break up with Jane. Mm-hmm. He tells his other brothers that he's going to break up with her, and it's very derogatory, and right. not
they can have their pick.
Right, they can have their, like pick. It's a very, yeah. As you see in the movie, it's the, and not to say this is what all fraternities and sororities are,
right.
But in this depiction of them, it's that the sororities are there to serve the fraternities mm-hmm. and be very subservient to them and meet their needs. And that kind mm-hmm. of a thing. So so then when he now says that he's going to, you know, he really kind of plays with her emotions. They have that moment where he's like, you know, you don't love me. You love the idea of me. But that's after he has called on her to sleep with Half Pint to prove mm-hmm. that he is a real Gamma man, because he wasn't going to let no virgin be in his fraternity, mm-hmm. which is all crazy and messed up and should not be.
Right.
But not to say that that's not the kind of stuff that
happens
right. and has happened, I'm sure. So that next morning when Half Pint goes to his cousin, who is Dap, and tells him this happens, then Dap then goes out and starts screaming, wake up, and rings the bell first thing in the morning. Everybody comes out. Mm-hmm. I'm expecting in a, your I guess, quote unquote, typical movie format fashion, is that there would be a confrontation between mm-hmm. the two of them, between Big Brother Almighty and mm-hmm. Dap, mm-hmm. and they would, you know, have this conversation, you know, why would you do that? Why would you treat her this way? You know, I was expecting that type of resolution, but right. that's not the resolution
that's
we got.
That's not the resolution we got.
Instead, we just got them looking at the camera and saying, wake up. So...
The wake up was on like multiple levels. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, dude, wake up. Because that was not right. That wasn't acceptable.
Right.
Wake up. There's, you know, stuff going on all over this world, and everybody wants to focus on a football game, a fraternity, let's party. Mm-hmm. There's things going on in this world we need to wake up and recognize.
Right. Because there's multiple themes throughout the movie that he's talking about. Because DAP is all about apartheid.
Right.
Anti-apartheid, which of course was a very big issue at that time with Nelson Mandela and South Africa, freeing South Africa. I remember that as a kid.
I've been in marches about it. Yeah. So
I recognized that reference. So there was the wake up to that, and then they have the conversation with the local yokels, and of course they had that conversation on the car ride back about what they're saying is true. Do we think we're better than them because we're going to college? Are we taking jobs from other black men because we have an education? And, you know, those are real themes that needed to be discussed. And I think Spike Lee did a great job of presenting those things in the conversation. And then you've got the conversation to begin with the colleges about why are HBCUs lacking in money? Why don't those that have graduated from the college give back into it, like Notre Dame, like other colleges that are Brigham Young, religion.
Predominantly white colleges.
Predominantly white colleges, but religious mainstream schools. School, or private universities or whatever. So so the wake up, I think.
It was a wake up on multiple
all those levels.
Wake up, why are we fighting each other?
Right.
Why are we fighting to be in a fraternity when we're all just one? Why are we fighting based on the tone of our skin color? We should all be one. We should all be together. Coming together. Mm-hmm. It's just wake up and stop doing this stupid stuff.
Right.
And, you know, and it's so funny because the whole wake up, and then now, of course, it's 2022 and it's
stay woke. You know? Which we had that conversation after watching the movie. It's like a lot of things that they talked about in the movie you hear phrases and terms that we're still talking about in 2022 that have come up in especially the last 2 years with a lot of civil unrest and racial.
Right.
Things that are in the spotlight, political, and this podcast is by no means to be political.
No.
But we have to still reference the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. 80s is a great time to go back, and we you know, I'm in a lot of Facebook groups. People talk about the good old days. I want to go back to the 80s. The 80s was great for some people, but it wasn't great for everyone.
It was not
right. Great for everybody. so anyway, just to kind of expound on that a little bit.
And so the wake up was basically. All the issues addressed in the movie, wake up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there was no need for a confrontation, although we might have wanted to see one.
Like I said, that's what I was expecting. When you don't get that, but once again, that wake up, when they're looking at the screen and saying wake up, saying it to me as a white man, that wake up isn't. I'm not going to understand that call to wake up.
Yeah, it's definitely different.
his audience that he was striving to make that statement to was not me. Now, can I still watch the movie and enjoy it for what it is? Mm-hmm. Of course I can. Am I going to get all of the lessons that he's trying to teach? No.
Probably not.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
Because it's still art. It's still an expression.
And it is Spike Lee's way of writing. That's how it...
Oh, yeah.
It's always somewhat complex. And you got to think, okay, what was he saying? You know? So, yeah.
Right. All right. Well, let's start to wrap it up. Talk about box office and critical success. So School Days was released on February 12th, 1988. It debuted at number 9 at the box office, behind other new releases, Satisfaction, which came in at number 8, Action Jackson at number 3, and Shoot to Kill at number 2, which is a highly underrated, great movie, Shoot to Kill, with Sidney Poitier and Tom Berenger. Great action thriller. The film received mixed reviews for its exploration of issues within the black community. Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times noted, quote, "There is no doubt in my mind that School Days, in its own way, is one of the most honest and revealing movies I've ever seen about modern middle-class black life in America." End quote. He also noted its frank exploration of issues of discrimination within the black community related to skin tone and nature of hair. He said it was significant as a film with a, quote, "completely black orientation. All of the characters, good and bad, are black, and all of the characters' references are to each other," end quote. And I think we talked about this is one of the first movies where black people were not, it wasn't a historical account of their history. It wasn't a drug pusher movie. It wasn't about crime. This was just a movie about a black experience.
All right.
Anything else you want to say about the movie?
No. At that time, it was one of my favorite movies, and I I lived it a little bit, so, yeah. You know, hey.
Still enjoyed it.
Still enjoyed it.
Cool. All right, well, thank you so much for being a part of this episode.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you'll be back. We got a few more down the line we're going to do that are not Spike Lee movies.
Right.
We got some other fun ones down the line, but we are going to try to do more movies that came out in the 80s that are more diverse mm-hmm. in its casting. Anyway,
wake up.
I need to wake up now. I'm tired.
Stay woke.
Yeah. But make sure you follow us on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter. Still doing my TikTok series on forgotten 80s flicks. So check that out. Send us a voice message. You can check out how to do that on the show notes. And send us an email. Tell us what you like, what you didn't like, what we need to cover next. Got big stuff coming up. Got some big things planned on the next couple of months. So definitely stay tuned. And that's it. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tim Williams for the 80s Flick Flashback. We'll see you guys next time.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we have a few ways for you to do just that. One way is to send us an email to movieviewspodcast@gmail.com. You can also leave us a voice message through the Anchor app. You can find the link to leave a voice message in our episode show notes. Hey, and while you're there, be sure to check out the episode show notes to find more fun facts and behind-the-scenes trivia we just weren't able to fit into today's episode. Well, that's all for now. Join us again next time for another 80s Flick Flashback.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.